A couple of people have been asking, where do I find your podcasts? There are two primary sources of my podcasts. The first one will be very, very easy for you. Go to Los Angeles Overeaters Anonymous, click on Events Speakers, and there's some big book stuff that I've done there through the years, just like what I'm doing this today. There's another absolutely different kind of thing, and that is where I go through every chapter from 1 through 7 or 6 of the big book with commentary. And that's going to be on a vision for you. A vision for you. And the number 4 rather than the word 4. And I'm going to be doing another one just on step 10 on September 18th on her special edition. So when you get to a vision for you,
that's our board.
No, I'm not exactly a technician. What I do is I go to a vision for you and hit enter, and it takes me right there. I'm more concerned with results. I don't know. Somebody said I have to take an Uber tomorrow to get to the airport. And I said, well, fair chance, I'm taking a cab. I don't know. I need a volunteer to take me. Maybe it's like 6 o'clock in the morning, something like that.
It's dot info, by the way.
Vision for you, the number 4, not the word 4, the number 4, you.info. Go under special events, and there I am. They're not all put together. Now, one of my friends, he's actually a sponsee of mine, he is very, very tech savvy. He and I are at opposite ends of this. He took all the work that I've done and put them in one email, one thing. And if you want me to, I will give you my email address. And if you just say you want my podcast on vision, I'll email you everything I've done up to September 18th. My email address is Harlan, H-A-R-L-A-N, 288, the number is 288@gmail.com. Harlan, 288@gmail.com. And if you just simply say, would you send me your podcast on vision, I will pop that out there to you when I get home or when I'm waiting in the airport or whatever. That's very simple to do, very easy. So those are the primary sources of the stuff I've done. From what I understand, we also have somebody who said that this is being recorded, which we know, and that he's not here, John, now. And I'm going to assume that this is going to be on L.A., Los Angeles, Multi-part. Okay, the guy that knows more about that than me is not here. He's the guy that dragged me to Santa Monica yesterday and the Roman Chinese theater. He's dragging me from place to place. And, oh my God, he wore me out. He's shrubbing me. He was about serious. He was Jewish for going to place. So, okay. All right. Now, before we get back into the text of Bill's story, we have something. Well, let me just refresh our memories here. Bill has been hospitalized twice. Once in 1933, once in 1934. He is drinking. He triggered the allergy on November the 11th. November the 11th is Armistice Day. You know November 11th as Veterans Day. But anyway, that's okay. Hey, I must look like quite a sight walking around like this, right? Well, I guess it looks better than what I saw. Okay. November 11th, Bill is in a restaurant/bar telling somebody that he met on a bus that he shouldn't drink, that drinking is not good for him. And the guy, the waiter comes and says, "Were you guys in the service?" And Bill says, "Yes." Guy flops down 2 years. But Bill and this other guy were in the army. Not together, but they were together that day. And the powers are telling this guy why he shouldn't drink, and that what happens to him while he's drinking, with no more forethought than that, he drinks the beer. And the guy says to him, "Are you crazy? After everything you told me." And Bill says, "I guess I am." But what happened after he drank the beer? He triggered the physical allergy. And he's good and drunk at that time on November 11th. This is the end of November. But let's take a look back. Let's rewind the clock. And what we're going to do right now is we're going to discuss the history of step two. Because remember that Bill has the problem defined for him by Dr. Silkworth. But Dr. Silkworth himself didn't know a solution to the problem. So let's take a look at a man who is born in Rhode Island. Very wealthy man, comes from old money. His family owns Burlington Mills Carpets. And if you've ever walked on a carpet, you probably walked on Burlington carpeting at some point in your life. Chances are very good that this carpeting here in this room is Burlington. Now, because carpets are usually made from man-made substances rather than natural materials like woolen cotton, they also own a very large percentage of the stock in a company called Allied Chemical, which is still traded today. This is a very wealthy man, and his name was Roland Hazard, H-A-Z-Z-A-R-D, Roland Hazard III. Roland was the wayward son of industrialists. He was the wayward alcoholic son of these people. And he tried many attempts to cure his alcoholism, which of course he can't do. One of the things he did was he had himself sequestered on a Caribbean island. And on the Caribbean island, the quartermaster, the guy that brings the supply in the boat, was instructed not to bring him liquor. So he didn't get drunk for about a year. He is off the island and he's drunk within 5 minutes flat. Roland really knew that he was going to die drunk, and he didn't like the idea of one thing. He wanted to give his mother and father the gift of seeing him sober just one more time. Now, I told you about the constellations of God's hand when Dr. Leonard Strong and Bill's mother were able to get Bill into a hospital with Thomas and have a doctor look at him. Dr. Silkworth, is it on or is it God? Roland Hazard in the early 30s was trying to get sober, and in the early 30s, what was also in his infancy was the art of psychiatry. And in the 1930s, in the early 30s, the most preeminent psychiatrist in the world, remembering money is no object to Roland, the most preeminent psychiatrist in the world is Dr. Sigmund Freud. Roland seeks him out. And Dr. Sigmund Freud is not taking on any new patients at all. He asks Freud, "Who's your number one protege?" And he tells him, "My number one protege is a man named Dr. Adler." Roland goes to Adler and seeks him out and says, "Will you help me?" And Adler says, "I'm sorry, Mr. Hazard, I'm not taking on any new patients right now." The third most preeminent psychiatrist in the world at that time did not live in the United States, but rather lived in Switzerland. And his name was Dr. Carl Jung, J-U-N-G, but pronounced Jung. And Roland goes to Dr. Jung in Switzerland, and he is psychoanalyzed and treated for 1 year and manages to stay sober for the entire year. At the end of the year, Dr. Jung says to Roland, Roland, my boy, you are ready to go home. We've done our thing. We've done our job. Roland goes to, first he goes to Paris, where he just happens to meet two wonderful friends of his parents who want to celebrate Roland's sobriety with a bottle of wine, bottle of champagne. And they crack open the bubbly, and they're drinking the champagne, and Roland is passed out on the floor because they don't have the twist of the mind, nor do they have the allergy of the body, and Roland does, and he is unable to walk and talk, and when he's able to walk and talk, he goes back to Dr. Jung with his tail between his legs, and Dr. Jung tells Roland, I have misdiagnosed you, my boy. You are going to die in your cups. Roland grabs Dr. Jung, and he says to Dr. Jung, is there no hope for someone like me? Now, is it odd or is it God that Roland didn't get to Freud? Is it odd or is it God that he didn't get to Jung, or to Adler? Because Adler and Freud believed that all solution lies within the mind. But Dr. Jung broke rank with them, which made it possible for us to be here today. When Dr. Jung told Roland that here and there were people who had experienced a spiritual experience, and it has changed them and altered them in ways which allowed them to heal. This profound spiritual experience was something that Dr. Jung called a phenomenon because he didn't really understand it himself. But he tells Roland of this, and Roland, encouraged by this news, encouraged by this wonderful thing that he's discovered, that he may be able to live, that maybe there is hope for him, goes back by steamship all the way to New York and makes it back to New York. But Roland wasn't really interested in exactly going to a conventional Lutheran or Protestant or Catholic or Episcopalian church or what have you. In his infancy at that time, in America, was also something called the Oxford Group Movement. Now, the Oxford Group Movement was not at all concerned with alcoholism. They were not at all concerned with anything like that. These were people that had taken their beginnings from a Lutheran minister who came from Pennsylvania in the United States named Frank Buckman. And Frank Buckman was the head of a group of people who lived in England near Oxford University, hence the name the Oxford Groupers. And he believed that the early Christians were willing to be eaten by lions and tigers to prove their devotion to Christ, to prove the love that they had for their Christianity, and he didn't see that anymore, and he wanted to instill this enthusiasm. There's a nice word, enthusiasm. It comes from two Greek words, enthekos, from God, enthekos, from God. And Frank Buckman went on a mission to China. And while in China, he saw people that had infused their Christianity and infused their love of Christianity with enthusiasm through service, through altruism to other people. And while seeing this, he is instilled with a zeal to pass this to other people. One of the people that he passes it to is in New York City. He's an Episcopalian minister, and his name is Dr. Sam Shoemaker. Sam Shoemaker is the head of the cavalry mission in New York, and Sam Shoemaker becomes Frank Buckman's right-hand man in New York,
and Frank Buckman and Shoemaker are not out to cure alcoholism. They're not out to help alcoholics. They are out to instill Christians with an enthusiasm for Christians that is akin to first century Christianity. In comes Roland Hazard. He meets a guy by the name of Stebra Graves Jr. There's a name you don't hear every day, Stebra. It kind of rhymes with zebra. I used to hate my mom for giving me the name Harlan. I said, why couldn't you name me David, John, Joe? What do you have to name me Harlan for? I mean, I could never get a pencil with my name on it when you go to these fuck-off places, and I could never get a cup with my name on it or something. So anyway. So, no, I kind of like it. But anyway, I didn't like it when I was a kid. But anyway, Steve Graves Jr., and he meets another guy by the name of Chef Cornell. And what do they have in common? What they have in common is that they're alcoholics and they're in here and they're working a six-step program based on absolute love, absolute purity, absolute honesty, and absolute faith, and they are staying sober. They're staying sober. Roland is very excited about this. Now, let's leave Roland alone. He's in his little Oxford group meeting in New York. We're going to go to Albany, New York. We're going to go to Albany, New York. And in Albany, New York, is a man by the name of Edward Ebby Thatcher. And Edward Ebby Thatcher, along with the Hazards, own homes in a place called Manchester, Vermont, which is where many of the wealthy people in New York and many of the wealthy people through New England have homes. I was just there. It's still beautiful. And Edwin Ebby Thatcher had a home in Manchester, Vermont, which is right next to East Dorset, Vermont. So he, and who was born in East Dorset, Vermont? Bill Wilco, I love this crap. Very good. I'm telling. I'm so happy. Okay. Spelling is rapture beyond belief. Technically, it's helped enough. Okay. I'm spelling here that you know. Okay, fine. So, Edwin Ebby Thatcher is embarrassing his family with his drunken escapade, and they say to him, get out of here and go to the summer home in Manchester, get the place cleaned up, we'll be out there in the summer. We'll be out there soon. So he goes out there, and he's hitting the sauce. And he's painting a wall while drunk, and some pigeons land on the wall. So he does what any normal drunk would do when pigeons land on the wall. He goes in the house, and about a half hour later, stumbles out with a shotgun. The pigeons are long gone. He starts blasting the wall with a shotgun. Well, the neighbors don't like that at all. So they call the police. Police come out, and they say, Eddie, if this keeps up, you're going to go to Brattleboro. Brattleboro is not only a city in Vermont, it is the location of the insane asylum in Vermont. It is where they put alcoholics at that time. In Chicago, we had Reed Center on Irving and Narragansett. I don't know what you have on here. But that's what they did with alcoholics at that time. They would institutionalize them because they didn't have treatment centers like, the town's hospital, yes, but most people couldn't afford that. So anyway, a little time goes by. Ebby's hitting the sauce again. He's on double secret probation. Remember from Animal House? He's on double secret probation. And this time he drives right into a woman's kitchen in his car. He's driving drunk. Right into the kitchen he drives. Doesn't have the slightest amount of contrition. Doesn't have the slightest amount of remorse. He says to the woman, hey, Toots, how about a cup of coffee? She starts screaming. She calls the cops. This is August of 1934. He goes into the county slammer awaiting assignment to Brattleboro Insane Asylum for his drunken disorderly escapades. This is late August of 1934. Now, beginning of August of 1934. We're back in New York. We're back with Roland and Seymour Graves Jr. and the Oxford movement at that time. Now, Roland is managing to stay sober. He goes home. His parents are telling. Again, please do something on you. Okay. He's telling. They're telling. Their son Roland. Their son Roland, really, they're butchical. Their son Roland is sober. And Mrs. Hazard and Mr. Hazard say to Roland, I want to pay for a vacation. Go enjoy yourself. Go and do. I used to have a neighbor. She was a concentration camp survivor. And she'd eat sunflower seeds in the backyard. And she'd ask us sometimes to do errands for her, which we would do. She'd always give us money and candy. I like the candy better, but I like fun. So she'd say, go and do so you can come back. I should be, oh my. Okay, now, so, Roland says to his friend, Seymour Graves Jr., my parents are going to pay for us to go on a vacation. So Seymour Graves Jr. says, why don't we go back, you know, you've got your house in Manchester, and my family is from East Dorset, Vermont, so we'll visit everybody's family. And they go back. And they hear about Evie, and Evie's about to go into the insane asylum. And Roland and Seymour knew of Evie. They knew his drinking. And they go before the judge. And the judge's name just happens to be Seymour Graves Sr. Is it alive or is it gone? I don't know. And Seymour Graves Sr. is about to remand Evie Thatcher to a stint in the Brattleboro Insane Asylum. They go to the judge and they ask Judge Graves if he would remand Evie to their care. And they will take Evie back to the Oxford Group meetings in New York City. The judge agrees. He calls Evie in early September 1934. Evie signed extradition papers. Extradition papers just means that he's agreeing that if he violates the contract of going to the Oxford Group and staying sober, he is to be remanded back to Vermont upon demand, and he will be put in the Brattleboro Insane Asylum. Everybody with me so far? Okay, good. It's about to get good. Not sexy, but good. Okay, now, they bring Evie back to the Oxford Group meetings in New York City. He's not exactly a fireball of enthusiasm or cooperation, but he's there because he doesn't want to go to the insane asylum, so he's there. September turns into October, 1 month sober. October turns into November, 2 months sober. For Evie, this is epic. Epic. 2 months sober for Evie Thatcher, epic. Now they say to Evie, hey, Ed, go give testimony. He says, what? Go give testimony. What's that? It's when you get a miracle from God. Now you go tell others what God did for you. Ever been to a Jewish family for a holiday? They tried to kill us. Some of us got away. Let's eat. But the bottom line is, same thing. The Passover story you tell from generation to generation. Teach this diligently unto your children. The whole thing with Purim and all this other, the holiday, doesn't matter what it is, doesn't matter. So you tell people what God did for you. And then he says, I don't want to go give testimony. I'm embarrassed myself. Talk about God, what's the thing? They says, oh, you don't have to go give testimony. We'll put you back in the insane asylum. And he says, oh, you know what? I think I'll go give some testimony. So this is the part where you can tell I raised a little girl. He's think, like Winnie the Pooh, think. I knew I was a father. I was driving down the street in Eugene, Oregon. This has nothing to do with Evie. Driving down the street in Eugene, Oregon, right? And I'm playing the music from Winnie the Pooh. When suddenly it dawned on me, she's not in the car! That's when you didn't know why. That's when I knew I was a father. Okay, now, so, Abby is thinking about who he can give testimony to and not embarrass the daylights out of himself. And he thinks of his old drinking buddy, his friend, his binge buddy, Bill Wilson. And he decides that if he's going to go give testimony, it isn't going to be with somebody that's going to embarrass him. It's going to be with somebody that he can be very comfortable with. He and Bill did lots of drinking together. Bill and Abby are very, very famous binge buddies. So he goes to Brooklyn, and he makes the call on Bill Wilson in November, late November of 1934. Let's go to the bottom of page 8. Now we're going to start to see Bill's life getting better on every page. Just like it was getting worse, now we're going to see it's getting better. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. Of course he would have dinner, and then I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility, the very thing, an oasis. Drinkers are like that. Eaters are too. Don't kid yourself. I had my binge buddies. I knew my binge buddies, and we were fast friends. There's a lot of marriages of people that come on real stormy times when you're binge buddies. And all of a sudden, that binge buddy turns into, let's get married. And then one of them gets into program, and the other one does not. If you've ever seen that in your life, I've seen a ton of it. And either one gets dragged kicking and screaming into the rooms and doesn't stay, or the other one gets dragged back into the food and is miserable. And that can, we all had our binge buddies, didn't we? Okay. The door opened and he stood there, fresh skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it, disappointed but curious. I wondered what had gotten into the fellow. He wasn't himself. Come, what's all this about? I queried. He looked straight at me, simply but silently. He said, I've got religion. I was aghast, so that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yeah, the old boy was on fire, all right, but bless his heart. Let him rant. Besides, my chin would last longer than his preaching. But he didn't know ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men, Roland and Seabrook, had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and practical program of action, which we'll describe later. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. He had come to pass his experience along to me. He had a separate thought, if I care to have it. Some of you are going to call me next week, and you're going to say to me, I'm sponsoring XYZ, and they won't put the food down. What should I do? Leave them alone, for God's sakes. Leave them alone, if I care to have it. I was shocked and interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. And hopeless for us means I'm out of ideas. And Bill Wilson was out of ideas. Bill didn't have any more ideas left in him. He talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that proper temperance pledge. I never signed. My grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folk and their doings. His insistence that the spheres really had their music. But his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen, his fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died, these recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard. So Grandpa Griffith had a profound effect on Bill. Grandpa Griffith was a real Vermonter. He knew that he wanted to believe in God, but he didn't want anybody telling him how he must believe in God. He didn't want anybody shoving anything down his throat. He knew that he believed, and that was as much guidance as he wanted. He wanted to make up his own mind. That wartime day in Winchester Cathedral came back again. And what did he see in that wartime day? He saw the tombstone of a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold, small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he dieth by musket or by pot, which means he saw the grave of a man who died from drinking too much beer, and it affected him. It affected him greatly because he didn't want to die. One thing we know about Bill Wilson, one thing we know about me, one thing we know about most of you, and that is this. In the final analysis, when you wanted to die, in the final analysis, when you thought that living was just pointless because you had no food, and you couldn't be happy without the food, and you couldn't be happy with the food, when you reached out for God, when you reached out for something other than a Kit Kat bar, God whispered on the last ember of your soul. And in whispering on that last ember of your heart, of your soul, it burst into flames and you came to Over Ears and Eyes. Now, chances are you didn't come here once. Because I was 37 years in this program, I've yet to see the person come in, walk in, sit down and get it. You come in and you go out, and you come, that's more normal, right? I'm not seeing any, okay. Let him whisper on that ember. Let him whisper on that ember, because this is not a dress rehearsal. And Bill is aware of the fact that he is destroying his life. He is destroying the life of his mother. He's destroying the life of his sister and his wife and his brother-in-law. And he's destroying the one life that he has. And this is what's going on in his mind as he's listening to this. And if there's two steps that are the most ignore the two steps that are the most underutilized, they are 2 and 10. 2 and 10 are the most underutilized, and 3 and 4 are the most misunderstood. We're going to get to 3 and 4 this afternoon if I just stop yakking, so let's get back down to business. Okay. I always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are, for that means blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher. A cipher is a zero, it's a nothing, and aimlessly rushes nowhere by intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much a precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation. But that was as far as I got. Now, one of the things that I make people do that I sponsor is I urge them very strongly, that's better. I urge them very strongly to come up with a definition of a higher power that you are willing to believe in. Because so many of us, for so many years of our lives, have had this idea of a God that never worked for us in childhood, and it never worked for us as adults, but yet we kept trying to shove the hippo through the dog door, and we kept trying to take this concept of God that didn't work for us as kids and make it work for us now, and most of us can't do this. I have to have a concept of a higher power that works for me and works in my life. And the God of my understanding is alive and flexible. The God I have today is not the God I had in May of 2010 when my wife told me that she fell in love with somebody at the office and wanted a divorce. And the God of my understanding today is not the same God that I had 10 years ago or 20 years ago. It is a changing metamorphosis. It is a changing thing. So I urge every one of you that are sponsors, and I urge every one of you that are the sponsees to come up with a conception of a power greater than yourself that you are willing to believe in. Because it says in the agnostics, do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe that there's a power greater than myself? That's all that's necessary. And I urge you not to have a God with skin. Because a God with skin is can be dangerous. If that's what works for you, fine. But if you're an atheist, can you recover here? Yes, you can. You just have to have a willingness to believe that there is a power greater than yourself. There's people that start with Lake Michigan. There's people that start with the Chicago River. Whatever it is that you, the Pacific Ocean, whatever you're willing to believe in, are you willing to believe? Nothing says you have to believe, it just says you have to be willing to believe. Are you the be-all and the end-all of the universe? Do you believe that there's something greater than you? That's all that's required. Okay, where am I? Ellie, help me out. With ministers in the world's religions, bottom of 10, right? Bottom of 10. I need some because John's not here. Somebody hold me to my place here when I... Okay. With ministers in the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ I conceded the certainty, top of 11, of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claim him. Watch your capital letters here, because when he's got these capital letters going, he's talking about God. His moral teaching most excellent. For myself I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult, the rest I disregarded. And that's what I did with my Judaism. I liked certain parts of it, lox and bagels. I liked certain parts of it, going to the movies on Christmas and eating Chinese food. But the other parts where they said for a couple days a year I couldn't eat at all, that was it. I was off the train. And I couldn't do this, and I couldn't yell at you at my mother. So screw that. I'm not doing that. Okay. The Lord, which here's a timeless paragraph that we could use in any time. The wars which had been fought, the burning chicanery and religious, that religious dispute had facilitated, made me sick. I could say that today. That doesn't change. It made me sick. Every time I pick up a newspaper, I'm vomiting in my mouth. Okay, I honestly doubted whether on balance the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging from what I had seen in Europe, and since the power of God in human affairs was negligible, the brotherhood of man a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal, and he certainly had me. But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute, and that was none at all. Now, what's happening here, guys? He is starting to see some things that are indisputable. What he sees is that Ebby is sober. And if you are sober, you are abstinent, you present the most compelling argument to believe or will it be willing to believe and to work these steps. What is he seeing here? He is forgetting about the splitting of the Red Sea. He's forgetting about the burning bush. He's forgetting Cecil B. DeMille can do much better than God when it comes to that. But what he is seeing is he is seeing an alcoholic of the absolute low bottom variety that he knows to be an alcoholic. He knows that this guy is an alcoholic, and yet he is sober. And that takes all arguments away from him. Now, there are theologians today that are going to spend their time thinking about what God is and what God is not. There are poets, there are authors, there are musicians, there are all manner of people, theologians, that are going to spend some time today trying to figure out who God is and who God is not. There are two things I need to know about God, and only two. There is one, and it's not me. Those are the only two things that I need to know about God today. There is one, and it is not me. And from that beginning, that there is one and it's not me, now I am beginning to understand that there is indeed a power greater than myself, that I alone cannot move mountains, to change the fact that I am a compulsive overeater and I'm going to die unless I have a spiritual awakening. But this is the flashpoint for me. This is the flashpoint. The bottom for me is when the fear of more eating is overwhelmed by my desire to stop, then I can recover. Then I can recover. Got to blow the nose first. When the fear of more eating is overwhelmed by my desire to live and to stop and to find out who I am, I get a question when I was in the food. What do I look like? Who am I? What could I be? What could I do with the one life that I had? Now, decades of that life were gone. Decades of that life, I threw away. I threw it in the garbage disposal and turned that thing on, and I will never get one second of that time back. However, if I remain faithful to this book, if I remain faithful to this program, I don't have to give it one more second. I'm going to live until I die, and I was dead while I was living. That's the difference. I was dead while I was living. Now, I'm going to live until I die. My father couldn't give me that gift because he was effectively destroyed by what happened in his life. My mother was mentally ill, but every dream that they could have dreamed for me, surviving the insanity that he saw, every dream he dreamed for me comes true when I work this program. When I work these steps, this is the best, greatest way of life in the world. If you're sitting in this room and you're eating or thinking of eating or wanting to eat, get somebody. Ask them, please help me. Nothing is going to happen until something happens. If you change nothing, nothing will change. You live in the most powerful intergroup in the world. There are people with decades of recovery here and meetings that are here that in other parts of the world are pure science fiction. There are people that call me every day from Sacramento, California, from Billings, Montana. I'm going to Bozeman, Montana at the end of this month. By the end of this month. Oh, yeah, you're like, oh, yeah. Anyway, we'll give you other things. But anyway, to them, having the number of meetings and the number of recoveries that you have in the greater Los Angeles intergroup is science fiction. You might as well tell them that dogs can play the piano. It's exactly the same thing. Take advantage of what you can. It's laid at your feet right here. This is my truth. There is a God, and it's not me. Okay, let's continue. Bottom of 11. They implored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in a human heart, which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revived right then. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. He shouted great tidings. I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing, top of 12. His roots grasped a new soil. Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. So he's not completely sold yet on this God thing. And there are a lot of people that I've encountered, including the man I look at in the mirror, that had a really hard time with this God thing. Again, I didn't get a pony. I didn't get to go to the prom. I didn't get to go to the makeout parties. I didn't get to go to anything like that. But I had trouble with this because if God is so great, why am I so fat? If God is so great, how come I didn't get this? If God is so great, why this, this, and this? I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of the Tsar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, and this next statement will open the door to tens of millions of people worldwide, not only now, but for the generations and generations to come. It says, why don't you choose your own conception of God? That opens the door. That's the product of Jimmy Burwell. That's the product of Fitz Mayo. That's the product of a lot of these guys, not just Bill Wilson. Why don't you choose your own conception of God? And that means more than you can be any religion you want or no religion. It means you can choose whatever God means to you. Whatever you have is a concept of that power that is greater than yourself. As long as it is greater than yourself and you're willing to believe in that power, you are on your way. Now, I've said to you that the first three steps are not working steps. They're conclusions of the mind. This morning, we've already covered step one. This is step two. That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlighted lab. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Who wouldn't want what Eddie was presenting Bill? He was sober. He was fresh-skinned and glowing. He wasn't drunk. He didn't stink from vomit. He didn't stink from peeing in his pants. He hadn't been arrested for 2 months. He wasn't living in the shame and the pall of remorse that alcoholism and food addiction and other addictions bring about. Bottom of 12. Thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want Him enough. How do I demonstrate that I want Him enough? I work the steps. Okay. At long last I saw, I felt, I believed. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me. For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have Him capitalize with me, and He came. Challenge God. Work the steps. Go to meetings. Help people. Stay out of the damn food. See where you can find God lacking. See where you can find Him a failure. You cannot do it. Does that mean He's Domino's and He's going to deliver in 30 minutes? No. No. It's going to take time and it's going to take work and it's going to take gut-wrenching patience on your part if you're anything like me. I saw my business going down and down and down and down and down, and it cost me my marriage. It cost me my child. It cost me my marriage. It cost me everything. 6 years ago, I walked out, a divorced man, on my own, for the first time in a long time. So I started doing something else besides my business. I did my business of selling radio airtime, but I also got a real estate license, and I started, because I'm very good on the phone, I started doing leads for a business broker. You know what a real estate broker is? They sell your house, business broker sells your business. And we sold a couple of small businesses here and there, and it was fine, but nothing solid, nothing steady. Last week, I cashed the biggest check that had ever been written to me in my entire life. A check that will give me financial breathing room. It will allow me to breathe. It will allow me to go, oh, thank you, God. But it took time, and it took work, and it took effort, and it took perseverance. You're going to have that same challenge in front of you. It's not going to... And the easy thing to do is to go, screw you, God, I'm just going to eat. That'll show him. He shakes up when you lay that one on him. You're going to have to hang in there through pain. That's why we have steps. We have steps for that pain. We have steps for fear. We have steps for anger. We have steps for jealousy and guilt and shame and remorse. We have those steps, but it's up to me to work them. cabins in the mountains, but I gotta bring the bulldozer. But soon his scent, I'm at the very bottom of 12, but soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors. Worldly clamors means I don't have enough of this and I don't have enough of this. Mostly those within myself, and so it has been ever since. How blind I have been. Now, this is 1934, December 13th, 1934. Bill has been in the Oxford Group movement a number of weeks now. He is sober, but he's not sober. He's going to meetings, but he's not sober. He's not sober. He's drunk. So he checks into the town's hospital. He's waving a bottle of gin. And he says to Dr. Silkworth, who's working on another patient, he's working on another patient on a gurney. He sees Bill. Bill's waving a bottle. And he says to Silkworth, "Hey, Doc, I've got something." And Dr. Silkworth says, "Indeed, my boy, go upstairs, take your clothes off, get into bed, and let's see what it is you've got," and continues working with the patient. He gets up there, and Bill's, of course, drunk. But what happened is Bill started going to these Oxford Group meetings. Now he wakes up on the morning of December 14, 1934, and the fog has been lifted, and he's sober. At the hospital, I'm at the tower of 13. At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. There I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing. Without him, I was lost. Steps 1, 2, and 3. Steps 1, 2, and 3. I ruthlessly faced my sins, step 4, and became willing to have my newfound friend, in capital letters, friend, take them away root and branch, steps 6 and 7. I have not had a drink since. So he's worked 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, and 7. My schoolmate visited me. That's Eddie. Eddie will bring with him a book. The book is called The Varieties of Religious Experience by William James, which is why we have stories in the back of the big book today. Eddie will bring with him, when visiting Bill, a copy of William James, The Variety of Religious Experience. If I hated you, I'd make you read it. It's painful reading. But what it is these people describe in their own way what they were like, what happened, and what they're like now that they discovered God. Does that sound a little familiar? Okay, good. We made a list of people I had hurt or tort. So he did step 5. I fully acquainted him with my problem deficiency, step 5. We made a list of people I had hurt, step 8, or toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong, step 9, step 10. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability, step 10. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would just become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly, my endowed asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request for my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure, step 11. So he has worked the first 11 steps, both with God and Eddie, while in the town's hospital in New York City, and let's see where he goes from there. My friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Simple, but not easy. I'm at the top of 14. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of life who presides over us all. These were extraordinary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory, followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. For a moment I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor to ask if I were still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. Now remember that we are here because of little things here and little things there. And Dr. Silkworth could have told Bill when Bill asked him, am I crazy? He could have said, yeah, you're cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Here, I'm going to inject something in your arm. You'll feel better. But he didn't do that. He was too great a man to do that. He saw that Bill was different. And he said to Bill, and I'll read. Finally, he shook his head, saying, something has happened to you I don't understand, but you had better hang on to it. Although if anything is better than the way you were, the good doctor now sees many men who have such experiences. He knows they are real. He said to Bill Wilson exactly what it says in here, and Bill knew that he was onto something. Now, before we read the next paragraph, let's remember that Bill is a selfish guy. He's an alcoholic. He is not exactly from the givers. He is in the hospital, and what happens in the wake of his spiritual experience? Now, the spiritual experience is sudden and profound. The spiritual awakening is slow and developing over time. He has a spiritual experience, and what happens? He says, while I lay in the hospital, page 14 toward the bottom, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might help others. Now, we do not know if Bill Wilson was the first person to get both the solution or the problem and the solution. But what do we know? We know that he is going to be the very first person in the history of Earth to take the problem that he got from Silkworth, the solution which came from the Oxford Group movement, and he is going to weld them together, and he is going to bring it to the world. He's going to bring it to the world in a way that is doable, understandable, and effective. And he is going to be that person. Why God chose him, we don't know. We have no idea. But we're just grateful that he did, because if it were not for this, we wouldn't be here today. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs, step 12. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to enlarge, perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive a certain trial in most spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. If he drank, he would surely die, and faith would be dead indeed, which often is just like that. What's important for me to remember is, no matter how evolved my recovery gets, I will never rise above the level of a human being. And as a human being, I'm going to need God more and more, not less and less. I need him more today than I needed him yesterday, and more than and tomorrow I will need him more than I need him today, because these challenges are too much for me to face alone. I can't do it. There's too much loneliness in life. There's too much guilt. There's too much shame. There's too much fear. There's too much anger. And we have steps for every one of those things. But I can't slug it out with those emotions on my own and stay out of the food. Because what will happen is those emotions will burst to the surface. They will create pain and suffering. My brain, in a desperate effort to stop the pain, will send me by the hair against my will into a gallon of ice cream. I will eat the ice cream. I'll trigger the allergy. I'll pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to eat the ice cream again, and I will repeat that cycle over and over and over and over again, the mind telling me that the food makes perfect sense while the body ensures it indeed does not. And that has been going on since the minute I was born. I have led the life of Sisyphus. Do you all know who Sisyphus is? He was a god, and his job was to push the rock up the hill. And no sooner would he push the rock up the hill, it would fall down the other side. And he'd push the rock up the hill, and it would fall down the other side. And he'd push the rock up the hill, and it would fall. And this was his life. This was Sisyphus's life. This is my life. I tried to eat the food safely, I couldn't do it. I tried to eat the food safely, I couldn't do it. I tried not to eat the food, I couldn't do that either.
So no matter what I did, I was a complete and utter failure. And now with the power of this program, I never have to fail again. I never have to get up on a day with the pall of that guilt, that shame, that remorse, that horrible feeling that comes over me when I've eaten. And no matter what I do today, I am okay with you knowing about it because I'm not engaging in any shameful behavior. A very, very famous man, not a famous man, but a very mean man that I told you about this morning over there, he said to me, if everything you did today, everywhere you went today, everything about your day, everything you said, everything was on the front page of the Chicago Tribune. Are you okay with that? Because if you're not, then you are keeping things secret unto yourself that you do not want divulged, and therein lies the disease. The Sam Shoemaker taught Bill Wilson and Roland and Eddie that there were four impediments to God. Four impediments to God. And we're going to be talking about that more in chapter 5 that we're going to get to in a minute if I shut up. But there are four impediments to God. The first impediment is a resentment that you will not let go of. The second impediment is a secret that you will not tell. The third impediment is a vicarious thrill that you will not stop. And the fourth impediment is a restitution that you will not make. Number one, a resentment that you will not let go of. Number two, a secret you will not tell. Number three, a vicarious thrill, stealing, lying, cheating, whatever it is, that you will not stop. And the fourth impediment is a restitution that you will not make. And this is the cat root of where we get our steps from. This is, if you see this, a resentment that you will not let go of, step four. A secret you will not tell, step five. A vicarious thrill you won't stop, six and seven. And a restitution that you will not make, eight and nine. So you've got the guts of the program right in those four things that Sam Shoemaker taught the boys. Okay, let's finish this chapter. Where am I? Oh. My wife and I abandon ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution to their problems. I was fortunate for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time. I was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink. But I soon found, to highlight this sentence, that when all other measures failed, to work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I've gone to my old hospital in despair. I'm talking to a man there, I'd be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It's a design for living that works in rough going. We commenced to make many fast friends, and a fellowship has grown up among us, of which it is a wonderful thing to feel a part. The joy of living we really have, even under pressure and difficulty. I have seen hundreds of families set their feet in the path that really goes somewhere. Have seen the most impossible domestic situations righted, feuds and bitterness of all sorts wiped out. I have seen men come out of the silence and resume a vital place in the lives of their families and communities. Business and professional men have regained their standing. There is scarcely any form of trouble and misery which has not been overcome among us. In one western city, Akron, Ohio, and its environs, there are 1,000 of us in our families. We meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. At these informal gatherings, one may often see from 50 to 200 persons. We are growing in numbers and power. An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic, and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some would be shocked at our seemingly worldliness and levity, but just underneath there is deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. That's a warning, and I need to take that warning to heart. That's very, very important. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. Most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. We have it with us right here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill to men. Phil Wilson died January 24, 71. Now, Lois Wilson, in the last page, it talks about in the book about how he comes home. He says to Lois, this doesn't work. I thought I'd be sobering up a bunch of drunks. God sent me this signal that I'm going to sober up drunks. I don't think this works. Lois could have said to him, yeah, you're right, stop doing that. She was too smart for that. God inspired her to say to him, but you're staying sober. And he says, oh, crap, you're right.
that's the first time in his adult life he was able to stay sober because he was helping other alcoholics.
Very, very important.
Let's go to chapter 5, page 58. Chapter 5. No chapter of this book has been written with more strife, arguing, fighting, than this chapter. The first four chapters were in the can. He knew that what he had done was, he thought what he had done was good. He didn't do it alone. There were people that had input. The manuscripts went back and forth to Akron. There's input in there from lots and lots of other people. We are not here because of Bill Wilson alone. We are here because of the effort of many, many people. Every time I walk into a meeting, I walk in on the shoulders of giants. That there are people who I will never know that made it possible for me to be here. Some of them only served as cautionary tales. They choked to death on their own vomit. They died in a gutter. They died in poverty. They died in shame. They died in horror of alcoholism. And they served to me as cautionary tales today through the words of this book. But every time I walk in here, I take a minute, especially in the morning when I do my 10th and 11th and I do my meditation, I take a minute to thank those who walked before me. They took butter knives, they took spoons, and carved out a path through the jungle with no inner group, no retreat, no convention, no early birthday, no t-shirts, no internet, no phone meetings, none of that stuff. They took spoons and they carved their way through the jungle so that I could just walk their path into recovery. Thank God for those people. At the end of her life, I had I went to Roseanne. I did a big book study at one of the birthdays, and she sent for me. I thought it was a mafia hit. I thought, when you get sent for, you're done. Oh, well, I'm not stupid. I know how that works. So I told her, I said, Rosie, you'll never die. This is 10,000 generations from now, 20,000 generations from now. What you did will be effective. Most philosophers agree that the 20th century will ultimately be known for three things in the millennium. Well, we were all alive in the 20th century, but 10,000 years from now that won't be the case. The 20th century will be known for three things. The first one, man's entrance into flight. The second one being the atomic/computer age. And number three, the development of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So what the 20th century will ultimately be known for are these 12 steps. He did not set out to write 12 steps. He did not set out to write any number of steps. What he set out to do originally was to close some of the loopholes that he saw the drunks jumping through in the six-step Oxford group movement. He knew enough about alcoholics to know that if you scratch a compulsive overeater, an alcoholic, or a gambler, or whatever kind of addict you scratch, you're going to get an immature rebel. And not only are you going to get an immature rebel, you're going to get someone who is very sensitive. We are sensitive, immature, and rebellious by our nature. Anybody not fit that description? We are immature, rebellious, and sensitive by our nature. As long as I can do things how I want and you do everything I say, then we'll get along just fine. That's what we are. We are rebellious, we are immature, and we are sensitive. The book and the first four chapters, as I explained, was in the can. And he was nocturnal. Remember I told you how this was the height of the Depression? The book was written in 37 and 38, and it was published in April of 39. This was the height of the Depression. He wasn't working. Most Americans were not working. And he became very nocturnal. He would stay up all night and sleep all day, which Lois just loved. But anyway, he was sitting in bed, and he had one of those yellow legal pads and a pencil, not a pen, a pencil. And he asked God for guidance, and he said within 20 minutes, this chapter was written. He said it was almost as if the pencil had a life of its own, that the pencil just seemed to run across the stage, run across the pages. I've been in L.A. too long. I've got to go back in. It's going to be about 30 degrees warmer, so I don't know whether to enjoy this or whatever. I don't know. Anyway, but pretty soon Arizona will be paradise. And once it gets about October 1st, paradise, until the end of May or the middle of May. Anyway, and we don't have to pay as much for stuff as you guys do. Our gas is 30 cents a gallon cheaper in Arizona than it is here. Is that questionable or what? I looked at the gas station and I thought, you're paying $2.40 for a gallon of gas. I pay $2.09. I left from Sky Harbor Airport to come here, I paid $2.09. That is messed up. That is totally messed up. Anyway, okay. Turn the clock the other way. Anyway, so he said, it was almost as if the pencil had a life of its own. And this other guy, this puke with about 6 months of sobriety, is knocking on the door. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning. Bill lets him in, and Bill says, look at what we have. And this guy says, what in the hell? We've had 6 steps up till now. Now you want us to get 12 steps? And the fight was on. And Akron got involved. And they want more God. And New York got involved. They want less God. Remember Saturday Night Live, more cowbell, more cowbell. Okay. So the fight was on. And the fight is getting intense. And finally, Bill is willing to make some compromises, but he says at the end, look, he says, why don't you guys finish the book? I can't fight with you anymore. I don't have it in me to fight with you anymore. You finish the book. And they said, no, we want you to finish the book, but take out some of the you and must and this and some of the absolute language, and some of it he wouldn't compromise on. And some of you would. Let's take a look at page 58, chapter 5, and let's see if we can't blow some holes into the 2 most misunderstood steps of 3 and 4, so that before we leave today, which will probably be about 11:30 at night, we can have a further understanding, a deeper understanding of these steps. But let's first go to page 58, chapter 5, how it works. And it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Notice the language there. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Now, what is it that you need to be honest about? Now, the obvious answer is everything. I understand that. But let's for just a second assume that we've got that down. What is it you need to be honest about? What you need to be honest about is the fact that you have an allergy of the body and a twist of the mind. The first 4 chapters of this book are designed to convince you that you are a compulsive overeater or are not. But if you're not convinced that you're a compulsive overeater, if you think you can do this on your own, what the heck do you need steps for? What do you need the book for? Okay. All right. So,
There are such unfortunates, thank you, they are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. And again, there's that idea of the rigorous honesty. Honesty about what? That I kissed somebody's wife, which I don't get to do, unfortunately. That I did this or I did that. No, that I am a compulsive overeater. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Now, if you're psychotic delusional, when you cannot tell the difference between real and false, then you probably can't recover. But as long as you can tell the difference between what is real and what is not real, you can recover. You can recover. Now, okay, let's continue. Our story, disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. Here's what I call step zero. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. If you decided you want what we have, what is it we have? We have people in this room right now that are not eating, and they are doing so happily. That they're not swinging from the chandeliers, starvation accident. That they're not on the gray sheet, and they're hoping that they're not going to fall off, and they're counting the minutes. They're trying to look at their watch, and I've got 6 hours and 14 minutes to go, and I'll get another day. That's not what this is about. That's not what this is about. This is about living in the freedom. It's about living in the sunlight of the Spirit. It's not about hanging from the damn chandeliers. And you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Are you ready to do whatever is asked of you? I ask this of people that I sponsor. Is there anything you won't do to recover? Because if there's anything you won't do to recover, there's nothing I can do to help you. Nothing at all I can do to help you. There's nothing this program can do to help you. If you're not willing to go to any lengths, then you are not ready to take certain steps. And how does that idea come into the consciousness of our minds? By suffering enormous pain. The pain of the food must outweigh the fear that you have of letting it go. The pain of the bulimia. The pain of the anorexia, the pain of the compulsive overeating must outweigh the fear you have of letting it go. And until that pain is so overwhelming that you cannot stand it anymore, there's little anyone can do for you. And some of these we bought. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go. Absolutely. Do you notice the exact language? The language of this is very, very absolute language, that there's no wiggle room here at all. The result was nil until we let go. Absolutely. Now, remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, top of 59. But there is one, notice it's capitalized, who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. In other words, here is a reiteration of this exact theme, that you're doing this or you're not. You're doing this or you're not. Don't you dare leave here today at 2 o'clock in the morning tomorrow, actually. Don't you dare leave here and not change something if you're struggling. Don't spit on me coming here. Don't spit on me coming here. I've got a German Shepherd weeping her eyes out back in Scottsdale because I'm here. She's very upset with me. Last weekend, she had to go to camp because I was in Boston. I took her to camp on Friday because I had to come here, and she was weeping in the car, and I put the window down for her, and the tow truck guy pulls up, and she's weeping and looking at the tow truck guy. He says to me, "What are you doing to that poor dog?"
I'm taking her to camp. I want to go to L.A. Oh, she was not happy. She was not happy. Okay. That one is God. Hey, you find him now. This is what she looks like, in case you're wondering. Half measures availed us nothing. You're either in or you're out. You're doing it or you're not. There is no gray area. It's a vending machine, guys. I love a good vending machine because I don't have to face a waitress. I don't have to face anybody. I can buy my food anonymously. See, lots of binging with vending machines. Oh, my God in heaven. But anyway, it's a vending machine. What happens if a product costs $5 in the vending machine and you put in $4.99? What do you get out?
Nothing.
Buckets. Nothing. A kadochas you get. That's what you get. That means nothing. So you get a kadochas, which means you get nothing. Okay, half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took. Let's go to page 263 in the fourth edition, and let's see where our steps come from. 263 in the fourth edition. I don't know those study guys. I don't know. Well, that's all right. I'll read them to you. You don't have to see them. I'll read them to you. These were the six steps before the book was written. Number one, complete deflation. Number two, dependence and guidance from a higher power. Number three, a moral inventory. Number four, confession. Number five, restitution. Number six, continued work with other alcoholics. And he saw that the alcoholics were jumping through these loopholes. They were jumping through, so he never intended to write 12 steps. Now, he was very happy with the number 12, because the 12 has great significance biblically, it has great significance throughout history and things like that. So he liked that there were 12 of them. All right, let's go, we're not going to read them. Page 60, let's go to the top, 60. Many of us exclaim, one in order, I can't go through with it, do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is, we are willing to grow on spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Now, you hear this at every meeting that you go to, unless you're playing with your cell phone or you're still out in the parking lot or you're trying to find a place to park. You hear the ABCs all the time. We're going to pull them apart now and maybe give them some new meaning, but we're going to look at those ABCs in a closer way. Our description of the alcoholic, that's chapters, the doctor's opinion, chapters 1, 2, and 3. The chapter to the agnostic, chapter 4, and our personal adventures, bless you, before and after, made clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. That's step one. Do you really believe that you are a compulsive overeater and you cannot manage your own life? Because if you don't believe that, you're not going to do this work. You'll still won't see the need. But if you do believe that, then you will do the work because you'll see that you're cornered. You'll see that it's checkmate. You'll see that unless you do this, you're dead. You're just dead. If you don't do this work and you're a compulsive overeater, it is not if you're going to die in the food. It's a certainty. It's just a question of when. If you're bulimic or anorexic or anorexic, it is exactly the same thing. B, that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. That no human power could have relieved your alcoholism. I'm going to mention some names right now. If you're too young to remember who these people are, you Google them. Jackie Gleason, Mama Cass Elliott, Karen Carpenter, James Gandolfini, President William Howard Taft, Fatty Arbuckle, Oliver Hardy, Elvis Presley. All these people had everything you could want. Karen Carpenter had the voice of an angel. She died at 94 pounds from her anorexia bulimia. Mama Cass Elliott died at 400 pounds at the London Palladium, shoving a sandwich in her mouth. She had the voice of an angel. President William Howard Taft was 350 pounds when he became President of the United States. he couldn't be elected dog catcher today because he was so morbidly obese. He was so morbidly obese that he had to have his bathtub brought out from Ohio because the provided bathtub that the White House had wouldn't let him put his enlarged derriere in the water. He had to have his bathtub brought out from Ohio. Jackie Gleason, a talent like you'll never see again, probably in this world. Comedian, TV, movies, the list goes on and on. Died of this illness. Elvis died of this illness. On and on. Did they have everything they wanted? Yeah, except abstinence. Did they have money beyond what you could imagine? Yes. Did they have power? Yes. Did they have faith? Yes. Didn't say them, did it. And see that God could and would if he were so. That God could and would. Are you looking at that page thinking maybe God won't? Are you looking at that page thinking God isn't going to do it? Change your God. Fire that God. Kick him out. Because that God will not let you recover because your conception is limiting. Fire that demon God. The God of Israel is a great God. No quarrel with him. The Red Sea, awesome. Burning bush, awesome. The oil that burned for 8 days when it should have burned for one, awesome. That God wouldn't keep me out of the food for 3 seconds. Wouldn't keep me out of the food for 3 seconds. That God was going to kick my ass. He told me what I could do and what I couldn't do, and I'd yell F you at my mother, and she'd yell back, and all this, and God's going to get you, and I went to Hebrew school, and I did this, and I did that, and one time I came home with a bad report card from Hebrew school, and this, and that. That God isn't going to keep me out of the food. Who am I kidding? There's nothing wrong with that God. It's not a bad God, but it isn't the God of my heart. It isn't the God of my understanding. And that's where you see people struggle. They're trying to shove the hippo out through the dog door. It can't be done. Get a dog. Get a dog. Get a dog. Okay. Okay. Get a dog and you get a what? Get a God that is willing to help you, that is there for you, that is going to help you in every aspect of your life. That's what I need. That may not be what you need, but that's what I need. Let's continue and let's begin step number 3. Being convinced of what? Being convinced that I need help, being convinced of the ABCs, we were at step 3, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that and what do we do? Our will is our thinking, our life is our action. Our will is our thinking, our life is our action. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. He's forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. What we're defining here, is the definition of selfishness. Selfishness in big book context has a little different meaning than it does in our English language. Selfishness in that time means the script. It's you want people to stick to your script. You have a script in your mind of what you think should be done, who you think should say what you think should be, and if people don't stick to that script, that will trigger this dissatisfaction, which will trigger fear and anger. the scenery, the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, there it is, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits. What usually happens? Now we're going to define self-seeking. Self-seeking is the action I take or the action I omit to try to get my own way. We're going to define that now. What usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, if the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhere involved, he is sure that other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only he manages well? What's a delusion? It's something that looks real, but is not. It's not real. Is it not evident to all the rest of the players these are the things he wants, and do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. He is like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation, the minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, politicians and reformers who are sure all of the utopia that the rest of the world would only behave, the outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him, and the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up. Whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, and our self-pity? So we're talking about that script that we have in our head. I've got a 21-year-old. I'll tell her what I think she should do. She'll use some golf words on me, so I'll let you know. Stick that one in your ear, because I'm going to do this, this, and this. I think, gee, you really shouldn't do that, that, and that. And she'll tell you, you know, no thanks. I'm going to do my own thing. And I have friends, and so do you, and I have whatever, and so do you. And you know what? We have this script. And that script is, this is what I think you should do, and this is how I think you should do it. And when they don't stick to it, it pisses us off, doesn't it? It really makes us mad because they don't stick to the script. This is the flashpoint. This is the flashpoint on these disturbances. That selfishness. Now, we're about 3 minutes from break time. Is that correct? Break at 2:45 or 3:45? 3 o'clock is the break. Okay, let's continue. All right. So, this is the flashpoint, is that selfishness. This is where we find that we're going to have trouble with the world that we're living in. Okay. Ellie, help me out here.
Selfishness, self-centeredness.
Selfishness, thanks. I'm at the top of 62. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will-run riot. That's an expression you'll hear a lot in OA. Self-will-run riot. A woman came up to me. I was in Dallas, Texas, doing a big book thing. Actually, Glen Rose, Texas, which is in the middle of God knows where. And she said to me, she read an article that chocolate is really good for you. And I said, that may be for some people. It's not good for people like me. And she walked away in a huff. She says, well, it's good for you, so I'm going to eat chocolate every day. And I said, God bless you. And now there's a peacock right over here outside our door. There's a peacock right there. Amazing, huh? That's a sign of something. I'm not sure what.
Google what peacock do I
got. Yeah, really. Google what peacock. Yeah, he wants a birthday party bookmark so he can make sure he makes it on the 13th, 14th, and 15th of January at the LAX Hilton. right?
Indefatigable.
He wants it. Okay. All right. Where am I? So, seeing for sometimes the past, we make decisions based on selfishly or place us in a position that we are. So, our troubles we think are based on. Oh, I did that already. We must, or it kills us. Above everything, we alcoholics, right?
Yeah.
We alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We muster, it kills us. God makes that possible. Can you rid yourself of selfishness?
Yeah.
Can your broken brain fix your broken brain? Absolutely not. We muster. There often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without His aid. Many of us have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own willpower. We had to have God's help. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. I do not know what's best for you. I do not know what is best for anyone. I barely know what might be best for me, and the key word there is might. Just when I think I've got it down, what I think I should have, what I think I should want, where I think I should be, God tells me that I don't know anything. I thought I'd be living in Chicago my whole life. God said, nope, you're going up to Eugene, Oregon. Then I went down to the Fiesta Bowl with my then wife and kid. We went to the Fiesta Bowl in Arizona, and they were crying on the way back because we were very lonely in Oregon. There was nobody around, really. It's just very desolate. I'm not denigrating the place. It just wasn't for me. But then we went down to Arizona, and we saw all these people that I have known my entire life. And then June the 28th of that year, we were living in Scottsdale, Arizona. And I've lived in Scottsdale, Arizona ever since. So, and I never thought I'd be out in Arizona, but yep, there I am. And here I am in Los Angeles. First of all, we decided in this drama life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are His agents. He is the father. We are His children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch which we passed to freedom. Now, I'm going to comment on this paragraph, and then we'll move on. But a lot of people read this paragraph, and they say, He is the director. Now, you guys live in L.A., where entertainment is like a king. The director tells everybody where to stand, when to say this, and how to emote that, or what to do, and what. That's the director, right? Now, I have a real estate license in the state of Arizona, which enables me to engage in business brokerage. Without it, I couldn't do it. I have what's called fiduciary duty to those I represent. What is a fiduciary duty, you may ask? That means that I am bound by Arizona law to place the needs of my clients above my own. I have a fiduciary duty to place the needs of my clients above my own. And that is what I must do with God. I must place the needs and wants of God above my own. There was a part of me that did not want to come here. I was tired. I had just been in Boston last week. I was looking forward to seeing a friend down here. She became very ill. She's not coming. There was part of me that I just didn't want to do this. I got my butt on that airplane and I came here because this is what I'm supposed to do to serve God. I have calls stacking up on my phone from people that I'm sponsoring or people that are reaching out to me. I can't return their phone calls right now. When I get back to that hotel room and I'm watching Oregon play college football, I will be returning their phone calls. You can bet on that because that's my job. That's how I serve God. His needs come before my needs. Now, it says here, He is the Father, we are His children. And I know what some of you may be thinking. Your father was not nice. Maybe he abandoned you. Maybe he beat you. Maybe he molested you. Maybe he was evil to your mother. Maybe he just was never around. Maybe he whatever. I understand. But this is the perfect Father. This is the Father in heaven. This is the Father in heaven. And so, we are His children. That means we're going to do His bidding. He is the principal. We are the agents. He is the father. We are the children. He is the director. We are the actors. We are here to play the role he assigns. We are not here to play the role we self-assign. That is very, very important for me to keep in mind. Topic 63, let's do the third step promises. When we sincerely took such a position, what position is that? The position of that we're here to serve God, that we're here to do God's bidding, that we're here to be the agent. He is the principal, we are his agents. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, watch your capitals. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, we discovered we could face life successfully. As we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. I am not the little boy that was born on May 24th, 1954, in Chicago. I'm not that little boy. I'm not anything close. I may have the same lineage as that little boy. I may have some of the same characteristics that he had, but I am not that little boy. In every sense of the word, I have been reborn. I came into this program, everything I despised and detested in a human being. A liar, a cheater, a manipulator, a duplicitous user of people, and a lover of things. I came into this program hating me and hating you. The greatest joy in life I had was your misery, and the greatest misery I had was your happiness. I wanted you to suffer. I wanted you to feel pain. I wanted you to feel the whip of what I had felt my whole life. And there was not enough pain to go out and ruin your life because I wanted you to feel what I had felt. There was not a stone that I would have left unturned to hurt my mother. I blamed her for everything. She was the bane of my existence, and her mental illness was absolutely to blame for everything that happened in my life, and I let her know about it every day. We're going to talk about 8 and 9, not now, but we'll talk about it. Today would have been her 99th birthday, and I have a very good relationship with her today. Not that I sit and talk to her, hey mom, how's it going? No, I don't do that, but I feel her here. And I know that when I do a retreat, or when I'm helping somebody, or I take care of my dog, or I take care of my house, or I take care of my business, I feel her with me. And that came after years and years of work. It didn't come from the thin air. It took a long time to repair that relationship. We are now at step 3, page 63. Many of us said to our Maker as we then understood him, or as we understood him. If you want to say this with me, say it with me, but you have to remember that step 3 is basically a covenant that you will do 4 through 12. You don't turn anything over to anybody in step 3. There's no turning anything over in step 3 to anyone. You turn things over in 4 through 12. You do not turn anything over in 3. So if you are prepared, if you haven't done 4 through 12, or you're currently living in 10, 11, and 12, or whatever, you can say it with me. But if you have no intention of doing the work, don't. Okay? God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me, and to do with me as thy will. Lead me of the bondage of self, that I may carry to do thy will. Take away my difficulties, and victory over them, and make their wisdom to those by the help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready to do it at last. Abandon ourselves utterly to him. And how do you abandon yourself utterly to him? By doing 4 through 12. 4 through 12.
So let's knock out one of those narishkites. Narishkite is foolishness. Let's knock it out that we turn something over to God in three. We do not turn anything over to anyone in three. Three is just the formal terms of surrender. All three is a surrender that says, I care. I'm now going to let you, by working these steps, and turn everything over to you. Your will is your thinking, and your life is your action. Now, we found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor, but it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. If you're holding something back, God, you take my food, God, you take my business, but I'll handle my love life or lack thereof, I'll handle this, I'll handle that, whatever it is, you're kidding yourself. You're either doing this or you're not. If I was so good at running my life, I wouldn't be sitting here now. I'd be God knows where doing God knows what. I am not good at running my life. My life sucks when I run my life. This was only a beginning. Now remember I told you that what we're going to learn is that step three is both a decision and a beginning. It's a decision and a beginning. This was only a beginning, though it honestly and humbly made an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. Next, not in a year, not in a week, not in a month, next, we launched out in a course of vigorous thinking. I mean vigorous dreaming. I mean vigorous action. Action! Next, we launched on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning. Why is it referred to as a first step? Because this is the first of the action steps. Now, I want to ask you if you will show me in your book where it says in a year, in a month, or whatever. It doesn't say it in my book. And I'm tired of getting calls from weeping people that were taking 6 months to a year to do a four-step. A four-step should take a couple, 3 hours tops. It should be done immediately upon concluding step three. I see some of you looking, you're glaring at me. Some of you are glaring at me. Oh my God, if looks could kill, I'd be vaporized. There is nothing in that fourth step that should take you weeks and months. Nothing. You know exactly who you're mad at and why. You know what you fear and why. And you know your sexual harms done others and your sexual ideal. If you don't, I'd be very shocked. Okay, so let's go up to 64, which many of us have never attempted. Though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once. Those are your timetables. Next and at once. Next and at once, followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom. We talked about that. So we had to get down to causes and conditions. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which had caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways, which was what defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. I'm going to try to explain the three basic instincts. I can't do it in 3 minutes. Let's break 3 minutes early, come back 3 minutes early, and I'll explain where anger comes from, where fear comes from, where jealousy comes from, all this stuff.